Okay, so this is the second session that we're looking at that very, very complex parting of the ways, because it is so crucial and so difficult to reconstruct. And there are so many theories about it and so many elements of it. So we've looked at all sorts of things. We've looked at the faith story. We've looked at the historical evidence. We've looked at the early followers of Jesus and the multiple groups that they split into. And we've looked at some of the tensions of the early Jesus movement. Was it going to be a Jewish movement? Was it going to admit non-Jews? And what criteria would it let non-Jews in? Did the Jews who belonged still have to go on being Jewish or not? Did the non-Jews who joined have to be Jewish, et cetera, et cetera? And we also talked about some other leaders of some rather odd groups, like the Marcionites, who were very, very anti-Jewish, amazingly, the Ebionites, who were very, very Jewish. We talked about Gnostic influences, not so much a movement, but ways of thinking that were influential in Christianity. Even if they were rejected, but still had influence. Were influenced in Judaism too. Gnosticism as a thought mode was around at the time. So now we've done that, we're going to look at three additional features of the parting of the ways. First of all, we're going to round off our discussion of the spectrum of different groups by looking at their attitudes to scripture, existing scriptures and new scriptures, and or some combination of the two indeed. And that was, we will find, was very, very closely linked to their sense of self, their sense of identity, of who they were, and also the way in which they were perceived by other groups. So that's the first thing we'll look at. The second thing we'll look at is some of the current academic ideas about how the parting of the ways actually happened. Some of them are horrendously complex, but I will try and simplify them because they're you know, I teach this stuff at university sometimes. It's quite hard explaining exactly what some people think. So I've tried to do my best. You'll just have to ask if it's not clear. And the last thing we'll do is we will catch up on what actually happened to Christians in the first 2.5 centuries. Those groups that we could call Christian, those groups that it would be difficult to call Christian, but we're going to have a look at what happened in those first 2.5 centuries. And then next week, we're going to have to look at see what happened after Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire, which it did quite late in 390 CE. So what happened up to that point? Okay, so here goes. Different groups, different canons. And the first thing we have to talk about is that word canon. And it comes via Greek, actually from a Hebrew root, kane, a reed or a measuring stick. And the idea of a canon is it's a set of scriptures that measure up, or set of books that measure up to some standard or expectation. In the case of a scriptural canon, probably that they are holy books or divinely written books or books of significance for religion. So canons are human affairs. They are usually decided upon by humans. And sometimes there's arguments about it. And the way to look at it at this time of history, we have to think about why did people have to make choices between books at all? And so a little digression on book culture in the ancient world. So books, as you all know, were handwritten at this point, usually on papyrus, which was fairly cheap. It didn't last terribly well, though. Or on parchment, which is animal skins and lasts much better, but it's much more expensive because, you know, you have to kill a whole animal and you'll need lots and lots of skins. As is one of the reasons why Torah scrolls are expensive, is they're written on parchment. So there were other forms of record. You could have little wooden frames filled with wax, and they were often used as notebooks. You could write with an iron stylus and then smooth out the wax. So they were around too. But it's been estimated that only 5 to 10% of people were actually literate, could actually read. Far fewer could actually write. So writing was very much a professional activity. Most people listened to books being read aloud. And silent reading to yourself seems to be very, very rare, and really until the Middle Ages. There's a record of Augustine, one of the early church theologians and father, known as a church father. He was very surprised when he came across his teacher reading silently in the year 384 CE. So again, it was not widespread. People read out aloud, much slower than we read now. Books, of course, could only be made by being copied by hand, and scribes and copyists very frequently would alter books as they copied them out. They think that word's wrong and they put their own word in. So it was very difficult to ensure that books stayed the same. And making books of any type, whether they were originals or copies, took the most immense amount of time. all the way up to when printing was actually reinvented in the West in the 15th century. The Chinese actually came up with printing. So you had to need a book very much or regard it as very important to make a copy or to pay for a copy to be made. It was very, very easy for books that weren't copied to just be lost by natural processes of the destruction, particularly of papyrus. You know, every 20 or 30 years, you have to recopy a papyrus book. And we know that there are tens of thousands of works from the ancient world that haven't survived. If you're lucky, you might have a title or a reference to them in some other book that has survived. But there must be tens of thousands of books that we don't know about. We also don't know who decided that a book was holy enough or important enough to be copied, that somebody had to invest in it. It seems to have been more a community affair that there were more copies of X around, and the books that weren't read or weren't seen as important or were seen as simply wrong simply didn't get copied and gradually died out. But we don't have any record of an individual or a group making a decision about what is in and what is out until in the 4th and 5th centuries, which is quite late, you get Christian theologians and Jewish rabbis making lists of holy books, of what is in the canon. But you don't get those lists before then. Canons were sort of somewhat open and a bit squidgy around the edges. So again, books that matched a community or a group's beliefs tended to survive. Those that didn't match might not have been used by that community, but they might have been used by other groups and copied by them. And the choices in what you copied and what you read and what you thought was a holy book very much reflected who you thought you were. And as those choices differ from group to group, they emphasize the difference and the bounds of identity of particular groups. So we might not be able to trace the exact details, but we can certainly see a growing trend of groups who define themselves and other groups by the choices they make about scripture, about what is in the canon and not in the canon. So if we start with the pre-existing scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, we can see how different groups define themselves in relation to those. Most Jews naturally went on using them, including the Ebionites and various early Jewish groups who followed Jesus. They would have regarded them as divinely authorized, and in the case of the Torah, definitely written by God and given to the Jewish people by Moses at Sinai. Just as naturally, Jewish followers of Jesus, like the Ebionites, didn't change their attitude to those books. They still thought they were holy. They still thought they were God-given. They may have added things, and we know the Ebionites had their own written accounts of the life of Jesus. They had variants of the Gospel of Luke. But they may or may not have regarded those as holy. We don't actually know. But another thing that's quite important is we need to realize that during that first century CE, the Jewish canon was not actually fixed. Now, the Torah was a done deal. That was it. Nobody thought the Torah wasn't holy. But some of the other things, I'm going to look at them in the handout, some of the other things were a little bit, you know, they might have been regarded as more or less holy. Okay, so we got the Torah, done deal. The Nevi'im, the prophets layer, there were some doubts as to whether to include Ezekiel or not, because it has details of sacrifices that contradict the sacrifices in the Torah. And there is a record in the Mishnah that the sages suggested it should be hidden away, i.e. just dropped silently. If you hid away a book and it wasn't copied, then that was the end of the book. And then somebody came along, Hanani ben Chizkiah, and he reconciled all the differences between the Torah and the book of Ezekiel, and the Chachamim, the sages, said, okay, we'll have it then. But even a book in Nevi'im could be the subject of dispute. And when you get on to the third layer of the Tanakh, the third layer of the Bible, the Kituvim, the writings, these don't seem to settle down for quite a long while. Some things were pretty clear they were in, like Tehillim, Book of Psalms. But other things were a bit iffy, and we have records in the Mishnah, particularly in Tractate Yadayim, about dispute over Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, Mishle, Proverbs, Esther. And we know that there was argument about those. And we have Rabbi Akiva, who is around at the time of Bar Kokhba, so 132 to 135 CE, having to argue very persuasively that Shir HaShirim should be in, because as late as that period, there were sages and rabbis who thought it should not be in. So we can see it was quite a fluid box, if you like, in the canon. There were other ones that almost made it in, particularly the book of Ben Sira. And the Talmud actually refers to Ben Sira on three occasions as a biblical book, as in the canon. How does it do this? It introduces a quote from Ben-Sira with the words, Shene'emar, as it is said, which is always cue for here comes a biblical proof text. And sometimes the word kakatuv, as it is written, is used. And both of those indicate that what follows them is biblical. So as late as the period of the Babylonian Talmud, some people still thought Ben-Sira was in. Though again, see, not everyone did by any means at all. And there were probably other books as well. We know about some of the books that were written by Jews during this period of the Second Temple, i.e. pre-70 CE. I've written some of them down here. As well as Ben-Sira, we have the first of the third books of Enoch. They were preserved by Christians, not by Jews. Jews got bored of them, didn't think they were interesting enough to copy. So we don't have those in Hebrew. We have them in other languages, like Ethiopic and Slavonic. The Psalms of Solomon, the Wisdom of Solomon. There were extra bits added to the Book of Daniel, the Epistle of Jeremiah, Jubilees, which is a vast book, absolutely huge. The Testament of Moses, the First Book of Baruch, Second Book of Baruch, Thanksgiving Hymns from the Dead Sea Scrolls. DS here means Dead Sea Scrolls. Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, also found at the Dead Sea. Temple Scroll, the Genesis Apocryphon. Fourth Book of Ezra, Apocalypse of Abraham, and possibly the set called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. And these are known as either intertestamental literature or pseudepigrapha. Some of them are considered holy by different Christian churches. The Catholics have some of these in the Apocrypha, some of them not. Anything that's just known from the Dead Sea Scroll is not actually considered holy by any Christian church too recently discovered. But depending on which church it is, some of these are regarded as scripture. But they're not regarded by Jews as scripture, and they're not regarded by Protestant Christians as scripture. So we can see already that even now, which canon you adopt has a lot to say about who you are. So I see that somebody's asked something in the chat. Oh, the source link. Yes. Ah, right. One moment. I'm going to have to go back to my email. It was sent to me and I forgot to find it. One second. Let's see. Share. Just see if I can find the link. Moment. Ah, here it is. Okay. Let's see if I can copy it without opening, which is always difficult. Chat. The four books of the Maccabees, yes, were also, two of them are in the Apocrypha and two of them aren't. They were also some of these books that, yes, the first Maccabees, you know, could have been scripture, wasn't quite. I also want to say, I see I have sinfully forgotten, to mention that the Learning Today is sponsored by two people. So I just want to mention that now because that's very important. So by Adam Dicker, in loving memory of his father, Zachary J. Dicker, Zachariah ben Shimshon Zal, so that his memory may be a blessing. And the second sponsor today is Donna Glassman, Alan Wellman and family, in loving memory of Donna's father, Yechiel ben Yechiel, Issy Glassman Zal, and may his memory be a blessing. So I hope our learning will indeed be a blessing for both those dear people who are being remembered. Okay, so we'll go back to the handout and we're going to have a little look and see how this actually works out. So if we think about those groups we were talking about last time, and as different groups developed and as time went on, we see different attitudes to these scriptures, and people had to reconsider their relationship with the books that Jews had originally produced. Could they still be holy for these new groups? As we've seen on this axis, on the sort of time axis going this way, sometimes, yes, they are. Sometimes the books of the Jewish scriptures were accepted as the prelude to what the group now believed, a continuation of the scriptural story which they were going to write or what they had adopted. And there were different strategies to bridge the gap between the what now became the Old Testament and the New Testament. And when we looked at the Gospels, we looked at some of those strategies and how you can make a link between them. So the gradual formation of a New Testament and new books redefine the existing scriptures as the Old Testament. They weren't new anymore, so they then get this label of being old. And in some cases, they were not seen so much as sacred books in their own right as a prologue, a prediction, or a preparation for the new books that had the essential part two of the story. But we've seen different ways of relating to the Jewish scriptures already. So, for instance, if we look at the top various Jewish groups, who might not have been part of the Jesus movement, would have had the Jewish scriptures. As time went on, and that sort of red line means continuous, this they might have been added to by various books of the Second Temple period, as we said, Enoch, Baruch, Ben Sira, etc. Some of these groups may not have survived. Some of their library didn't survive. But just standard Jews might well have had what we now regard as the Tanakh plus various other add-ons. The group who eventually come to form Rabbinic Judaism, which is what we have inherited, we know what they did. They hung on to what we regard as the Tanakh now. Eventually, the canon did close, and you couldn't put new things in sometime in the 2nd, 3rd century CE. And what is interesting, we'll come back to this, is they then seemed not to have collected more written texts, but to have switched to oral texts. So we know that the Mishnah, which is formed or edited roughly 200 CE, we know that was not a written text for a long time. Rashi thinks it wasn't written down for another 600 years. And it was probably a memorized text. And things like the Tosefta and the Midrash also have a lot of signs of being memorized text, not written text. So one of the things we might consider is the fact that once you've got a certain lot of books, you might not want to add to them. And if you want to say some more stuff, you might say only orally. And we do have this idea of Torah Shebe'el Peh, the Torah in the mouth. And that is one of the Jewish responses we'll see, possibly, to the proliferation of new scriptures. We talked about the Ebionites. Well, they would have kept the Jewish scriptures, yes. They also added on, as we saw, new scriptures, part of the Gospel of Matthew, maybe the Gospel of the Nazarenes, but their group died out, and we don't have the Gospel of the Nazarenes anymore because their books went with them. The proto-Orthodox Christians, the group that eventually won, if you like, accepted the Jewish scriptures, and saw them as connected to what is now the New Testament, which again was only canonized the 2nd to 4th century CE. And there were other books that didn't get in, like the Epistle of Barnabas, that some of those that group actually thought should be in the canon. When we go on to the Gnostic groups, we're not too sure if they made any use of Jewish scriptures. Maybe some groups did and some groups didn't. As we saw, Gnosticism was not a united movement. It was a way of thought, and different groups adopted different aspects of it. But they definitely did involve new scriptures like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Truth, the Treatise on the Resurrection, which again we talked about last week and which we know best from the Nag Hammadi finds in Egypt. Other early Christian groups, again, there were lots of groups we don't know about, lots of groups that we do, but I didn't mention last week, may or may not have adopted the Jewish scriptures. They might have had reservations. They might have taken them on completely. They certainly, we know that they did develop new scriptures, things like the Gospel of Mary, the Proto-Gospel of James, which have either been preserved by chance or that we don't have anymore. And again, many of these groups didn't survive because they lost to the Proto-Orthodox group. And then the last group we mentioned last week, the Marcionites, who we know didn't want the Jewish scriptures at all. They saw them as demonic and as evil because Marcion had this idea about the bad Jewish God and the good God who had sent Jesus, who was from a completely different world. And we saw that their canon consisted of parts of the Gospel of Luke, some of Paul's epistles, and probably writings by Marcion. But again, they died out and were suppressed by the proto-Orthodox Christians. And one of the things that's very, very hard for us all to realize is the fact that what we have now is probably only one of the possibilities that there were back then. So we think that Judaism, has been the same forever. But I have to tell you, there are a lot of groups in Second Temple periods who thought very differently from the way we think, notably the Dead Sea sect. And there were other groups, there were Sadducees, there were all sorts of people, Essenes, what have you, and they didn't survive. The people who won were the people who eventually produced Rabbinic Judaism, and that's why we think of it as normative. But it's quite interesting to think that if one of the other groups had been the ones who survived, or say two of those groups that survived, not one of them, after the destruction of the temple, Judaism might look very different today. We don't know. And the same with Christianity. It hasn't always been the same. There were all these various groups, the groups that we didn't mention, the Marcionites, the Ebionites, the Gnostic influence groups. There was a multiplicity of groups, and we'll see more next week. But only one set or allied band of groups won. And they did lead to what became mainstream Christianity. But at the time, at the very beginning time, they were only one group out of many. And again, the Christian Bible could have looked very different if, say, the Gnostics had survived as a group. We might actually have Gospel of Thomas and Gospel of Truth being read in churches. Who knows? So this was such an important period for the formation of those groups altogether. And then, of course, for which ones survived and which ones didn't. And this is very, very much tied up with the question of what did they see as Holy Scriptures. So I said also, I'd just mention a bit more about the fact that the tradition that has survived for us, what we see as mainstream tradition, does seem to have rejected a lot of these new ideas and been very suspicious of new written books. It's difficult to tell whether that's a reaction to the fact that early Christians or followers of Jesus are writing their own new books, or maybe they're not the Gnostic stuff that's out there, but our sort of spiritual ancestors seem to have had a real, real allergy. And we have texts that record that dislike of adding scriptural books. And here we are, the Tosefta, which is a bit like the Mishnah. Nobody can decide if it's slightly earlier or slightly later. In many places, it's parallel to the Mishnah. And it says the Gilyonim, which a Gilyon is sort of like an addition, really. It has been suggested this is actually from the word Evangelion, gospel. So could be talking about the gospels? We really don't know. There are lots of theories. And the books of the Minim, and the Minim means sectarians. And again, there's huge argument about who the Minim are. Are they early Christians? Are they other Jewish groups who the rabbis don't like? Do not make the hands impure. Now, this is a sort of a code phrase, meaning they are not holy. I know this sounds completely backwards, but the way in which Jewish texts talk about a book being holy or being part of the canon is to say that it does make the hands impure. And this is such a wacky way, because you think it would be the other way around. I better explain it. So the theory, though nobody, again, quite knows, but the theory is that holy books were stored together with holy grain, with truma grain, which had to be kept in a condition of purity and then given to Kohanim. It's a mitzvah from the Torah. And the problem was, if you store books and grain together, when rats get in to eat the grain, they will also nibble the books. And the rabbis introduced a takanah decree saying that holy books would from now on make the hands impure, and that would stop people storing them with grain, because you couldn't touch truma with impure hands. Therefore, they would be stored away from the grain and the rats wouldn't get them. So that is the rationale that is usually given by this, for this phrase, it does not make the hands impure, meaning it is not holy. And conversely, it does make the hands impure, tame, as it meaning it is holy. So that's just a little side thing to this very odd phrase. So all these books of the Minim are not holy. The books of Ben Sira, and remember we said that Ben Sira was the sort of one that almost got in, and all the books written from then onwards do not make the hands impure. They're not holy. Okay, so as Tosefta saying, that's it. We're done. We've got our full set of holy books. And Ben Sira is not one of them, by the way. And anything anyone produces in the future, that's not going to count. In the Mishnah, in Sanhedrin, we have another interesting little viewpoint on this. These are the people who have no portion of the world to come. And there's a whole list of them. The one we're interested in is Rabbi Akiva says, also someone who reads in the Sparim Chitzonim, the external books. This is sometimes understood to mean the books of the Apocrypha, but it could just mean any book that isn't a holy book. You're not to read any outer book. Only our holy books that we've agreed on can be read, and you shouldn't read anything else at all, or you will lose your place in the world to come. And if some of these books are rival scriptures, you can understand why Rabbi Akiva might say that. And then a bit later, Midrash Kohelet Rabbah is 3rd, 4th century, nobody quite knows. Somebody has written, anyone who brings into his house more than the 24 books, i.e. the Tanakh, the Bible, such as the Book of Ben Sira, again, it's singled out, brings chaos into his home. So this is a really anti-New Book set of texts. And there are some other texts that tend to point the same way. And it looks as though Jews felt very, very suspicious about new written books that claim to be holy. And one possible reason for that, again, I can't tell you conclusively, but one possible reason for that is there are newly written books, including by Jews, out there which are claiming to be holy. So, for instance, if the Ebionites have come up with something, I can see the rabbis going, no, you can't read those books. No, they're traits. They're not holy. We're not going to do any more written books. We will compose our next works that we need in our heads, in our memories, and we will transmit them by memory. And then nobody can make a mistake. And that might also explain this whole idea of Torah Shebe Al Peh, Torah Shebichtav, written Torah and oral Torah. And also why we stopped being so fussed about oral Torah, because there were very, very strong prohibitions on writing down any book of the oral Torah. And let's face it, they're all written down now, because it's round about maybe 800 CE. People did write down the Mishnah, and people did write down the Talmud, and people did write down the Tosefta. So clearly, eventually it stopped being a problem, or it wasn't seen as a necessity. And again, that might have been when it was just too late to do anything about crazy groups writing rival scriptures. So it wasn't such an urgent problem. Plus, those groups might now have been so separate from Jewish groups that there was no danger that somebody was going to go off and read Christian scriptures, because the Christians were the Christians and they weren't us. So it's possible that this Jewish aversion to new written books had something to do with this whole plethora of rival or potential scriptures that were being written at this period. I'm just going to look at the chat because I see there are questions. Okay, Cheshmonim 1:4. Yes, that's the Book of the Maccabees. One to two are in the Apocrypha. The other two are not in the Apocrypha. I do actually do a whole lecture about why the first Book of Maccabees is not in the Bible, because it jolly nearly was. Right. Are there any other questions? Do you think that all the New Testament is apocryphal? I'm not sure about apocryphal. The Apocrypha is a group of Jewish authored books that are appended to the Bible by certain Christian denominations. They're not considered holy by Jews. Books like Ben Sira, Wisdom of Solomon, Tobit, Baruch, I can't remember which numbers, Baruch might be one and two Baruch. So there's a whole, and First and Second Maccabees. So there's this whole group that Protestants don't think are part of the Bible. Catholics do think part of the Bible. They're all Jewish authored, but Jews don't think they're part of the Bible. So that's the Apocrypha. So it's something separate from the New Testament. Are there any books in the New Testament worth studying? Well, yes, they're all worth studying if you're interested in early Christianity. I wouldn't say they're worth studying to improve your knowledge of Jewish thought today, but if you're interested in comparative religion, and indeed for what was happening with the Jews in the first century, they are very, very interesting. If you do want to actually read the New Testament for yourself, I would recommend getting the Jewish Annotated New Testament, which is published by Oxford University Press. And it's edited by Amy Jill Levine and I think Mark Brettler. And it's most interesting. It's New Testament considered from a Jewish point of view with a running commentary and lots of fabulous essays at the end. So if you ever want to study the New Testament, that's the best one, I would say. Were the other Jewish groups like Conservative and Reform today? No, not at all. Modern denominations are very much their own thing. Modern denominations are all based on Rabbinic Judaism. All of them. These early groups didn't all accept the same set of books. Plus, of course, things like the rabbinic writings. This is really pre-rabbinic. This is before rabbis become a thing. If you've ever wondered why Hillel and Shammai aren't called rabbis, it's because in the time of Hillel and Shammai, there weren't rabbis. There were scholars, but there weren't rabbis. Rabbis are a late first, second century thing. It's a very different situation. Did the sect believe that the good God sent Jesus believes that Jesus was not Jewish? Yes, the Marcionites didn't think Jesus had anything to do with Jews. No. Books of scrolls and expensive, kept them in barns with grain, either kellers or hiding them. No, Truma grain, well, sacred and had to be kept in conditions of Tahara. So you probably had a very special, very careful and very, very well protected place for your Truma. So that would be a good place to keep special items like holy books. It was all holy and lumped in together. However, the rats didn't care. The grain kept the scroll dry so it didn't rot. Entirely possible, actually. No grain, no food, no food, no life. They stored grain in the most secure way possible. Indeed, yes. but rats. I have rats next door because they are chickens and there's chicken feed. Believe me, rats can get anywhere. Okay, so we're going to move on to academic theories. And yes, if it gets complicated, ask me questions. So we've surveyed a lot of the facts that we do have. We've surveyed a lot of the facts we don't have. And we've looked at the different groups that were around before the death of Jesus and after the death of Jesus and how they related to scriptures. So let's have a look at some of the modern theories about the parting of the ways. How did Judaism and Christianity become the very separate things that they clearly had after 200-300 years, though not at the beginning? So before the mid-20th century, most studies of the origins of Christianity were by Christian academics, and they tended to see Christianity as a new flowering of the highest type of religion that had left behind the primitive and backward Judaism from which it had come. So, you know, you can imagine Jews were not very interested in this. But by the mid-20th century, some people had noticed this was a bit on the biased side, and it gave way to a much less negative image, where Judaism and Christianity were seen as splitting apart at the time of Jesus, a bit like a road that forks in two directions, hence the image of the parting of the ways, which, and these paths continue in separate directions. So there was this idea about, okay, you know, it wasn't old Judaism followed by new Christianity and old Judaism just dies off. It was more Judaism, Christianity divide at this point, which is, you know, slightly nicer, but still actually quite a Christian idea, as we'll see. So we're going to talk about Daniel Boyarin first. His contrast to the older theory of a gradual parting of the ways was that actually that parting of the ways happened much later than people thought, and it was quite artificial. He thinks that there was a long, very diverse spectrum with all these various groups at different points on it, that they merged into each other, and people might visit, you know, two groups or feel they belong to two groups or more and have relatives in other groups. And it was all much more fungible and far less divided than people later thought. They all had different ideas about Jesus and his message, from Jews who were uninterested in Jesus to Jews who thought he was an important teacher to Jews who thought he had been the Messiah or some sort of prophetic figure, but maybe wasn't now, to Jews who thought he had a unique status as a son of God, to non-Jewish followers of Jesus who took on Jewish practice because they wanted to be like Jesus, to non-Jewish followers of Jesus who didn't think it necessary to preserve Jewish practices, but had their emphasis on faith in Jesus, to other non-Jewish groups who worshiped Jesus as divine, not human, and rejected any human and Jewish origin for him. And there were probably lots of other combinations and variations. So if we think of these not as hard and fast groups, but more a huge spectrum of people who sometimes clumped together because they thought the same thing and sometimes were difficult to place on that spectrum. So that's what Boyarin thinks actually was happening in the first couple of hundred years. And he notes that religious ideas and practices crossed between the groups for centuries, and that different groups shaded into each other and probably didn't think of each other as other until much later, various authority figures on both the Jewish and the Christian side started imposing those boundaries, generally in terms of what did you believe. And they then started defining those on the wrong side of the boundary they had made as heretics or others. And again, I come back to Lubavitch, not because it is really parallel, which it isn't, but just it's very interesting. If you look dispassionately at Lubavitch, there could have been a mass outcry by mainstream Orthodox rabbis that Lubavitch was heretical and treve. And in fact, there have been some rabbis who said so, notably David Berger, who does regard them as heretics and wants a wall between. But so far, the community reaction has not been to do that. But you can imagine a different scenario where it did. In the meantime, we still have this sort of fungible, not exactly a boundary between Lubavitch and the rest of the Jewish world. So if you think about it in those terms, you can sort of see this is, you know, quite possible. So for Boyarin, this imposition of boundaries is what creates the groups. They weren't there before until people wanted them. So there was a deliberate discourse of heresy and orthodoxy on the part of leaders from both sides. And that, according to Boyarin, is what created a separate and often hostile Christianity on one side and Judaism on the other. And it wasn't a simply naturally occurring drifting off process. It needed a kick to start. And he sees it with Christian theologians beginning to accuse some groups of whom they disapproved of being Judaizers or Jews. and they begin constructing Jews as demonic figures. And in simultaneously, rabbinic culture evolves a category of minim, sectarians, which may well have included Jewish followers of Jesus. And again, minim are bad people and you mustn't read their books and you don't want to associate with them. So the heresy police, you could say, of both sides, according to Boyarin, co-create two mutually exclusive groups of what become Jews and Christians. But it didn't start that way. It's also interesting that earlier accounts of early Christianity did tend to imagine a pure original Christian faith that was handed from Jesus to his disciples and from them to Paul and the earliest Christian groups. And then what happened was people distorted those ideas and heresies developed, which had to be attacked and kept away from the original pure faith by vigilant theologians and church leaders. But as we've noticed, more recent research has actually shown that things were the other way round. At the very beginning, there were lots and lots and lots of different ideas about who Jesus was and what Christianity was, or what it meant to follow Jesus. And only later on did some of those groups become heretics, according to the people who eventually won. But they weren't heretics at the beginning. So what we think of now as the proto-Orthodox group are the ones who won, and history is written by the victors, and they wrote Christian history. Christianity has always been what we say it is, and everyone else back at the beginning who thought wrong was a heretic and had deliberately distorted the original pure thing. But as I say, history does seem to be the other way around. And what's also interesting is there were other early churches, the Armenian and the Coptic church in Egypt and the Syriac church, and the Western church that develops out of the proto-Orthodox group branded a lot of those churches as heretical too. Those have survived till today, those churches, but they're mostly not in communion with, they're not sort of joined up to, if you like, things like the Catholic Church. So Boyarin said, yeah, it's a story of history written by the victors. That's what happened in the Christian church. And the invention of heresy not only drove some Jewish Christian groups out of what became the main body of the church, but it also defined and strengthened that boundary between Judaism and Christianity. So he says that this really was paralleled in the rabbinic world, and that this process went on for several centuries, at least up to the 4th century. And in the 4th century, as we'll see next week, Christianity by then was spread very widely through the Roman Empire and became its official religion in the 390s. And only then, says Boyarin, can you speak of Judaism and Christianity as two completely separate entities. And he evolves his theories by looking at early texts like the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the rabbinic world and early Christian writers like Justin Martyr and Jerome and Athanasius. And he reconstructs the sort of ideological work they're doing, drawing boundaries and noticing the hidden areas in which they really reveal what's actually happening. He also claims that as part of this process, Christian writers invented the notion of a religion. There hadn't really been religions before. There were ways of life. Boyan points out that this is really still the Jewish idea, but this is why we have such difficult ideas about what is Jewish identity and who is a Jew and can you be a Jew without believing in God and what is ethnic Judaism or cultural Judaism or supposed to religious Judaism. And we spend a lot of time beating ourselves up about it and also find that very often if you've had contact with members of other religions, you often find that it's quite difficult to explain how some people can feel very, very Jewish, but not necessarily go to shul or do anything. But Boyarin would say that's the preservation of a pre-religion outlook when you were who you were and it was a total identity, not just a religious identity. So he says that actually the Christians came up with this idea of religion as something that you signed up to by belief principles and was the separate part of your life as part of this whole process of rejecting a Jewish religion, which they had to construct in order to be the other. So in some ways, for Boyarin, the two sides co-create each other simultaneously. So we'll move on to Judith Liu, also interesting. She says this original or semi-original parting of the ways model, this fork in the road idea, is only one of several possible models, and nobody at the time would have accepted it at all because they didn't see it like that. For instance, some early Christian writers like Justin Martyr said that Christians were the true people of Israel, and anyone who rejected Jesus as Messiah and Son of God had been rejected by God. So he didn't see the parting of the ways. He saw a complete replacement, what's called a supersessionism. So parting the ways was not anyone's theory when it was actually happening at all. Some pagans in the other direction, like philosopher Celsus, accused Christians of being pagans who had adopted Jewish myths and ideas, but wouldn't adopt Jewish traditions and practice. And they were completely dishonest and hypocritical and didn't think they were genuine at all. And that doesn't fit in at all with the parting of the ways model. So Judith Liu says we should look at the parting ways model much more closely and see what it implies. She grants it recognizes the Jewish roots of Christianity and the continued vitality of Judaism rather than the old model that just said, well, Judaism died when Christianity was invented. But she said it doesn't really tackle the problem of continuity between Jews and early Jesus followers. You know, how did that thing actually happen? How did things go? And we've tried to explain it, but it's still difficult to explain. And also this question of canon, as the Jesus movement became more and more non-Jewish, this question of how do you relate to the Jewish scriptures comes up more and more. And what do you do with those scriptures? They keep talking about the people of Israel. They talk about God's promises to Abraham and his descendants. How do you fit that in? And that became an increasing problem for non-Jewish Christianity as time went on. And again, one of the major answers for the proto-Orthodox group was the supersessionist answer. We have replaced the Jews as the true people of God. There was this phrase, Verus Israel, the true Israel. And that was very common thinking all the way through the Middle Ages, right up to the 20th century, where, thank heavens, it has been dropped by many, many churches. So not all Christians felt that. The Marcion wouldn't have liked that at all. He wouldn't have seen his followers as the new Israel. He thought the old Israel was bad enough, didn't want to be the new one. So Judith Liu says what we need to do is look at on the ground at particular instances, at particular communities, at particular groups. We need to really see how things worked in practice and look at it really at ground level. How did outsiders divide up people? Some pagans couldn't tell any difference at all between early Jews and Christians, just thought they were all the same thing. And what does that tell us about how separate or mixed those groups were? The Roman historian Tacitus, who we looked at early on, knew that Christians originally came from Judea, were linked to Jews, but his contemporary Suetonius thought they were a completely new group and didn't realize they had any Jewish connection at all. So again, it's difficult to know exactly what was going on at the time, but if we look at the evidence, we see we have much more evidence of that fuzziness. By looking at inscriptions, by looking at books, by looking at archaeological things, buildings, the religious languages are used, what is shared, what is not shared. She thinks this is a much more productive way of actually looking at that very crucial two centuries and trying to work out a bit more what actually is going on and how does it vary from place to place, because it's quite clear not just one thing that's happening at all. The third scholar we'll examine is Israel Yuval, who wrote this very influential book, Two Nations in Your Womb. And he looks at Christian attitudes to Jews and Jewish attitudes to Christians in late antiquity. And he goes on to the Middle Ages too, and how the two groups mutually influence each other and construct an other that reflects who they are. In other words, you define who you are by telling yourself what you are not, and you push that what you are not onto the other group. The title of the book, you'll notice, comes from the story of Rebecca, who has the twins Yaakov and Esav, who develop into two nations, she is told. And what is interesting is later rabbinic interpretations of that often take up Esav as not just the ancestor of the nation Edom, the Edomites, who are known from the Bible, but as the symbolic ancestors of the Romans and then Christianity as a whole. So Esav in Midrash often means Christians, not always, but very often. And of course, Yaakov is the correct brother, the good younger brother who gets the blessing and is the true chosen one of God. But for Christians, they read it the other way. They read certainly, maybe not now so much, but they did read it the other way round. Jacob symbolized Christianity, the younger brother who is chosen by God. And Esav is the Jews who are exiled and redeemed and rejected by God. So again, you've got this common use of a biblical symbol, but early Jews and Christians are reading it in completely contrasting ways, saying, you are the other, I am the chosen by God. So again, Yuval looks at this from the writings of Paul onwards. It first appears there and in other Christian writings. And he looks at Jewish writings as well and notes the sort of development of this other group. And he does apply that also in the Middle Ages to pairs or shared sets of symbols like Pesach versus Easter, martyrdom versus the blood libel, the Eucharistic bread and matzah. So he does some very, very interesting things on those two. And again, his approach shows how closely Jews and Christians are always intertwined, even when claiming to be utterly different, and how the identity of one often rests on the identity of the other, which is something that I'm hoping is coming out of this course a little bit. Okay. There are a couple of other really important scholars, if you want to look at some of the academic theories, Paula Fredrickson and Martin Goodman are good people to look at. Okay, so having discussed the parting of the ways, we're going to see what actually did... Oh, actually, on second thoughts, before we do that, I'll look at the chat because I see there are questions. Where are we? Let's go back to there. Oh, thank you, somebody who's put the annotated New Testament link in. Excellent. Chabad has two factions, pro and not Mashiach. I suspect that saved them. Quite possible, yes. But again, David Berger wrote a book, which I actually edited, called The Rebbe, the Messiah, and the Scandal of Orthodox Indifference, which certainly expresses a quite extreme Jewish opinion, mainstream Jewish opinion about, no, these people are not Jewish, they're a different thing altogether. And it's just fascinating because of the parallels in the way that people decide some group is beyond the boundary. I'd say at least three factions, the Pro-Mashiach group are open about it, pro that keep it hidden, and the not. Yes, very true. Introduction to the Apocrypha. Oh, yes, do that. That would be fantastic. How much weight do you place on the insertion of the Birkat HaMinim into the Amidah by the early rabbis, or the exemption of early Christians and the Roman Fiscus Judaeus on the parting of the ways? Oh, huge, huge question. Well, Birkat HaMinim is, I could do a whole session just on Birkat HaMinim and various theories about it. I'm not even going to go into it because it's so complex and there are so many different ways of understanding that. It really is a whole thing. But yeah, you should look into some of the stuff that is written on that. There's vast amounts. The exemption of early Christians from the Roman Fiscus Judaeus. Yes, certainly after 70, the Christians have become much louder about the fact they're nothing to do with the Jews, partly because they don't want the Jewish tax of Fiscus Judaeus is the tax demanded by the Romans as sort of a reparations for the first Jewish revolt. Based on the fact that Jews used to give a shekel or half shekel to the temple, and this was diverted to the Romans to the treasury of Jupiter Capitolinus, a nice pagan temple in Rome. Yes, obviously by the time they decide that, there are clearly enough Christians who are going, we're not them, for the Romans to do that. I'm not actually sure when about the history of how the Romans disentangle that, because I can imagine a load of people going, I don't have to pay the tax for all sorts of reasons. The Barry Wilson book, I don't know anything about, but I'm sure it's good. And yes, the definition of religion. Yes, it's hugely difficult for Jews today to conform to Christian defined definitions of religion because we're not. We're not a religion in the way that Christianity is. We're an ethnic unit with its own faith complement. So it's terribly, terribly hard to try and get this over. I spent ages trying to explain to people why people are Jewish even if they eat pork. Other than Mila, which mitzvot did the early Christians abandon piecemeal or at once? Well, all of them, really. There was Paul made a bit of a thing about not eating sacrificial meat, but again, I think early Christians did avoid meat that had been sacrificed to idols, which meant a lot of meat in the ancient world. So as far as I know, that one did last for a while. As pagan sacrifice died out, Christians today, I think, wouldn't even be aware of that. Later on, you get a revival of certain mitzvot, certainly after the Reformation. So Protestants get much more excited about Shabbat, for instance. They go, well, the Bible says we should be resting on the Sunday, which, of course, having changed the day from Shabbat. So you get a sort of renaissance. But nobody ever revives, for instance, Kashrut, except for the Seventh-day Adventists and a few sort of fairly marginal groups. So it's very much... it's quite a pick and choosy thing after this point, really. Okay, on to the last bit. Christians as a persecuted minority faith. So while the Jews were having a terrible time in the first and second centuries, what with the first and the second Jewish revolts, and we were being, massacred and expelled and generally have a tough time, Christians weren't actually having it that easy either. So the earliest followers of Jesus were not very popular among many of their co-religionists who disagreed with them, and there was strife, and it was sometimes violent. So we have in the New Testament the account of Stephen, the first Christian martyr, who was recorded to have been stoned by fellow Jews. And Paul was certainly beaten, stoned, and thrown out of various cities. So yes, just like today, people sometimes get quite violent about religious opinions. However, the Jews weren't running the empire. So there was a limit to what Jews could do to other groups of Jews, or Jews and non-Jews who they didn't like, because the Romans would have stopped you. But the Romans disliked the Christians as much as they disliked the Jews. The Romans were not big fans of the Jews. Like the Jews, the Christians wouldn't take part in the official cult of the emperor, which meant sacrificing to the emperor and the goddess Roma, who symbolized Rome. And that was civic life. If you wanted to be a magistrate, if you wanted to be anyone in any little Roman municipality around the world, you had to do special ceremonies involving sacrifice on the emperor's birthday and on other particular days. And you couldn't get away with not doing it. So that meant that Christians wouldn't take part in public life. And they were seen as deliberately flouting the law of the empire and deliberately being rude to the emperor, deliberately disassociating themselves from their fellow citizens. So they were very suspect. Now, Jews had a bit of an out here because the Romans knew the Jews were mad and they knew that they just wouldn't sacrifice to the emperor. But there had been a lot of Jewish yelling about how loyal everyone was and you know, praying for the emperor and making sacrifices for the emperor at the temple and so on. So Romans had a sort of a bit of an escape clause for Jews. They wouldn't make Jews work on their Sabbath, and they did let them off sacrificing to the emperor. I'm not too sure they allowed them into public life, though, because if you wouldn't sacrifice to the emperor, you really couldn't do that. But Christians didn't have that out. So the full force of the Roman Empire did fall upon Christians quite hard, possibly harder than on Jews. And the historian Tacitus recorded that the Emperor Nero blamed the Christians when a great fire devastated Rome in July 64 CE, and he expelled them from the city. Didn't expel the Jews, he expelled the Christians. Romans had a general impression of Christians, and everyone knew that Christians hated mankind because they wouldn't sacrifice to the public welfare, and they were dangerous criminals, and everyone agreed they had to be punished severely. They hadn't sacrificed the gods. They married their brothers and sisters. This may have been some misunderstanding because a bit like Muslims today, actually, Christians used to call each other brother and sister. And then, of course, if they got married, there might be misunderstandings around them. And Romans also often thought that Christians ate human flesh and drank human blood. That would have been misunderstanding the Eucharist, the communion or mass service. So as an example of the general Roman attitude to Christians, that they followed a depraved superstition that was harmful to society, we can read the letter of Pliny the Younger. He wrote to the Emperor Trajan. Trajan was Emperor 98 to 117 CE. And at the time, Pliny was in a position of authority in Bithynia, which is part of modern Turkey in the West. And he was investigating some people who had been accused to him anonymously of being Christians. And we're going to read the letter, which I did once have to do for a Latin exam, actually. So this is from about 103 CE. Those who had denied that they were or had been Christians, when they invoked the gods in words dictated by me, offered prayer with incense and wine to your image, which I had ordered to be brought for this purpose, together with statues of the god, and moreover cursed Christ, none of which those who are really Christians, it said, can be forced to do, these I thought should be discharged. So he has them up, he gives them a test. Okay, he's had this little anonymous note saying, oh, you should know that these people are Christians. So he says, all right, you turn up. Here is wine, here is incense, here is the statue of the emperor, here is the statue of the gods, and I want to see you recite the following words and pour out some wine to the gods and light incense and invoke the gods. So he said, okay, those who did it, I decided they weren't Christians because apparently Christians won't do those things. Others named by the informer declared that they were Christians, but then denied it, asserting they had been, but had ceased to be some 3 years before, others many years, some as much as 25 years. They all worshipped your image and the statues of the gods and cursed Christ. So they conformed. So I let them all. They all said they weren't Christian anymore. They asserted, however, that the sum and substance of their fault or error had been that they were accustomed to meet on a fixed day before dawn and sing responsively a hymn to Christ as to a god, and to bind themselves by oath, not to some crime, but not to commit fraud, theft, or adultery, or false, nor falsify their trust, nor to refuse to return a trust when called upon to do so. Which is interesting because this gives us a little vignette of what possibly Christian or possibly former Christians had been doing. They were praying together early in the morning, one day a week, maybe it was Sunday. They were singing a hymn to Christ as to a god, and they were swearing they wouldn't do bad things. When this was over, it was their custom to depart and assemble again to partake of food, but ordinary and innocent food. They're not eating humans. They're just saying, we just had lunch together. Even this, they affirmed, they had ceased to do after my edict, by which, in accordance with your instructions, I had forbidden political associations. And there's the key. The Romans think of this as political association. It's something that they're going to be plotting against the emperor if we let them do this. We're not having illicit so-called religious groups meeting together. No. So an edict had gone out and these people are saying, well, we used to do it, but then you put your law out and we stopped right away. Maybe yes, maybe no. Accordingly, I judged it all the more necessary to find out what the truth was by torturing two female slaves who were called deaconesses. But I discovered nothing else but depraved, excessive superstition. Now, this is again interesting that, first of all, the torture, by the way, was completely legal in Rome, and you could certainly torture people to get evidence if they were slaves. You couldn't torture free citizens, but of course you could torture slaves because they weren't really people. So that's interesting that there are two female slaves who have the position of deaconess. Now, we know about deaconesses. They were an early form of Christian minister, and we know that there were women ones, and these were slaves and women. So that does argue for quite an egalitarian notion in early Christianity. Later, of course, the church decided that women couldn't do anything at all. There is a contemporary movement in the Catholic Church to reinstate the deaconesses, and I think the Pope just did agree to that, if I'm not wrong. But that's quite interesting that this picture that we have from other sources that women were attracted to Christianity and slaves were attracted to Christianity seems to be borne out here. So what else did Pliny say? Pliny says, I therefore postponed the investigation and hastened to consult you, for the matter seemed to me to warrant consulting you, especially because of the number involved. For many persons of every age, every rank, and also of both sexes are and will be endangered. But the contagion of this superstition has spread not only to the cities, but also to the villages and farms. And here we have interesting evidence that there's a lot of Christianity about in Western Turkey round about the year 100. And it's affecting everybody. It's not just one social group. But it seems possible to check and cure it. It is certainly quite clear that the temples, which had almost been deserted, have begun to be frequented. In other words, people had left pagan temples because they're all going off doing Christian stuff. But no, people are coming back. That the established religious rites, long neglected, are being resumed. And that from everywhere, sacrificial animals are coming, for which until now very few purchasers could be found. Hence, it is easy to imagine what a multitude of people can be reformed if an opportunity for repentance is afforded. In other words, I think probably here you would want to be quite lenient, sir, because things do seem to be moving in the right way, and we don't want to make martyrs of these people. And if we say to them that they can, we'll forgive them if they worship properly, nice pagan idols, then I think that's probably the way to go. And we do have Trajan's answer, and he commends Pliny, says, yes, I think you've dealt with this very well, and he agrees there shouldn't be a witch hunt for Christians, but they should be punished if they are denounced by informers and then they are found to be guilty. In other words, if they refuse to sacrifice and they refuse to curse Christ, then yes, they should be punished. But otherwise, just, rein it in. We don't want to really make this a big thing. So the persecutions reached their height under the Emperor Diocletian, who reigned 284 to 305. And there was a period of about 8 years when there were very severe persecutions of Christians, much worse than under Trajan. And it's been estimated between 3,000 and 20,000 Christians may have died for their faith. The emperor instituted reforms across society at the time, and his persecutions of Christians were part of this much bigger attempt to return to the empire to a much earlier, purer stage with proper, nice worship of the traditional Roman gods. So it was part of a bigger policy. Churches were burnt down at this point. Holy books were burnt. Church property was confiscated. And as we said, many Christians did die as martyrs for their faith. And there are lots and lots of acts of various martyrs, books recording or stories about them that were recorded at the time, more or less legendary. There are a lot of miracle stories too. And many Christians who died at this time are still honored as saints. And martyrdom at this point became a very, very high ideal in Christianity. It was seen as the absolute sure way to heaven. If you were killed for your belief in Jesus, then definitely you would get the life to come, no problem. Many others, of course, did evade their persecution, as you can imagine, by concealing their faith or even going back to paganism, which it seems was probably what happened to the people that Pliny met in Bithynia. They were so terrified, they just went, you know, don't think we'd better die. We'd better go back and do a bit of sacrificing. And when it's safe, you know, we might go back to the Jesus group. But I'm not quite sure at the moment. It doesn't seem wise. And again, very human response. You can understand that too. Okay, so I'm just going to see if there are any other messages here. So where are we? I understand Rabbi Hood and the Sea Correspondent got along with the Roman governor. Nobody knows how historical the stories in the Talmud about various different rabbis having friends with various different Roman emperors. So there's stories about, I think it's Rabbi Hudanasi and Antoninus Pius, who was one of the Roman emperors. Whether it's historical, nobody quite knows. It's interesting why those stories might appear. Again, part of that rabbinic stance, which tended to downplay revolting against the Romans because they'd already seen what happened to them. This idea that Dinah Malchut Adina, you know, the law of the land is the law, unless it stops you being Jewish. Again, the rabbis as a group seem to have been quite against militant action, with the possible exception of Rabbi Akiva, who supported Bar Kokhba. But certainly after Bar Kokhba, the price paid was so terrible that most rabbis afterwards just sort of said, keep your heads down. You know, don't try rebelling against the Romans. So the stories of different rabbis being friends with different Roman emperors or high officials may be part of a tendency to try and say, look, we can get on with them. And you know, we can even influence them. And please don't try any more uprisings because it will end in tears. I've heard pastors refer to miracles in the Old Testament that predicted the coming of Christ. I've also heard Jewish scholars that Christians wrote the Old Testament to include these miracles and clarify. Well, no, the Christians didn't rewrite the Old Testament. They had various translations with here and there the odd bit. Basically, from the second century on, the main Christian way of reading the, quote, Old Testament was to read it typologically to see everything as predicting Jesus. So near sacrifice of Isaac, the Akedah, that's a prefiguration of the crucifixion. I don't know, the announcement to Sarah that she's going to have a baby, that's a prefiguration of the Annunciation to Mary. So basically, just read it backwards. And in some circles, that is still very much the way of reading the quotation Old Testament. But churches like the Catholic Church and the Anglican Church and the Methodist have stopped this rather supersessionist way of reading it and saying, no, we realize that these are Jewish scriptures. And we don't think it's the whole purpose of them is to foretell the coming of Jesus. But it's reading backwards. You know, basically everything is Jesus. Oldest extant copies of various Gospels. There are some fragments on papyrus from Egypt, which are, I'm trying to remember now. Second century? We haven't got anything complete till, I think, Codex Sinaiticus is the earliest complete version of both the Septuagint and the New Testament. And that's about 300-ish. That's in the British Library down the road from me. Very nice. But we don't have very many, we don't have full copies, I think, before then. And some of the early witnesses, well, what we call textual witnesses on papyrus, are slightly different from the Gospels that are the sort of standard version of the Gospels that you get in the Christian Bible now. There are bits that are left out. There seems to be a certain amount of textual fluidity for quite a while. Bart Ehrman's books are quite good on that too. I think I've put him in some of the earlier sort of reading lists here. And they're all in Greek. Later on, then you get Coptic translations and other translations. What was so attractive about early Christianity that many were drawn to it? Well, women had positions. That was very nice. It was unusual. Later on, this claim that there's neither free nor slave, neither woman nor man, etc., and, you know, we're all equal together, later on that was sort of subverted. And as we know, Christianity became a very hierarchical religion, but at least some early Christian groups seem to have been remarkably egalitarian and didn't mind if you were a slave and didn't mind if you were female and didn't mind if you were handicapped or poor or what have you. So for the underclass, which would have been the great majority of the Roman Empire, here was a faith that allowed you to participate. There were lots of religions going around at the time, some of which, you know, would have been quite good competitors, like Mithraism. But Mithraism was men only and very military based. So, you know, women weren't interested. Slaves couldn't the Kama Mitra is. There was the cult of Isis. That was for women only. And it was rather Egyptian and exotic and not seen as very local. And a lot of high-class women were devotees. There were all sorts of possibilities, but definitely Christianity, certainly in its early years, did make a huge appeal to people who were very dispossessed and marginalized and not proper members of society and powerless in many respects, and they were allowed in. And certainly in the early years, you know, women could be deaconesses and they were very prominent in the early church. They then get edited out later. So, yeah, it would have had a big appeal. A very big appeal. For those people who like the Jewish side of things, it was sort of like, a bit like Judaism light. You know, you could have the Jewish scriptures. You didn't have to do all the circumcision and kosher stuff. Any evidence of synagogues converted into churches by membership which switched? No, I don't think we do have any. Early Christians are willing to milah but willing to die. Yes, yes. Nobody gets heaven for just, you know, having bits of yourself cut off, but dying, yeah, you get heaven for that. So apparently, yeah. I think actually by the time the martyrdom thing comes big, nobody's talking about circumcision anymore. The circumcision debate was the first 100, 150 years. By the 300s, that was over. Nobody thought that you needed milah to become Christian. Ironic how by Aaron, the Jew is on one of the world's most radical anti-Zionists, while evangelical Christians have become Zionist strongest supporters. Indeed, yes, his Bayern is extremely anti-Zionist, indeed. But he's good, he's a good scholar. Right. I don't know what not that I know of, the first two. Okay, are there any more questions? Because I think we're a tiny bit over time. But if anyone's got any urgent questions, I'm very happy to have a go at them.
Thanks. So what was it that made the
early Christians be so willing to sacrifice like they do? I mean, that seems to be a bigger thing in Christianity, both the sacrificing your life, martyrdom, and the Mother Teresa kind of thing. That seems to be a much bigger element of Christianity than Judaism, which wants a more holistic life, being married, you know, the middle path, that kind of thing.
Okay, well, the theme of martyrdom had developed in Judaism already, and Christians may have learned it from there, during the Maccabean revolt. So if you read First and Second Maccabees, martyrs are glorified. There's a story of Hannah and her seven sons. Actually, I think she might not be Hannah. She's Hannah later on. She's the woman and her seven sons, all of whom were martyred. If you look at Second Maccabees, it's full of martyr stories, and Fourth Maccabees is even more full of martyr stories. So martyrdom is a huge thing in Judaism from the time of the Hanukkah story onwards, which is when it enters Jewish culture, and it was very, very big indeed. And of course we have, you know, we have rabbinic martyrdoms, like, you know, the story of the 12, the Elias Kara story, the 10, 12, can't remember because I never read it all the way through, that we read on Yom Kippur, including Rabbi Akiva. So that's the context of the Bar Kokhba revolt, in which many, many people were martyred, definitely. So martyrdom was a very big thing in Christianity. If you look back at the handout, I wrote some of Boy Aaron's and Liu's major books, and there's one called Dying for God, which is about the development of martyrdom discourses in both Judaism and Christianity. So, yeah, it was a very, very big thing for both religions, not just for Christians. But to provide martyrs, you have to have a hostile environment. So when the environment is hostile, there's lots of martyrdom that's bigged up, like for Jews in the Middle Ages too. And then when things are a bit better, the martyrdom sort of sinks down a bit more, and you remember past martyrs, but you're not rushing out to do your own so much. What was the second? There was a second part of the question. You said that martyrdom and, sorry, I've already forgotten because my memory is terrible.
And sacrifice of a certain kind that seems to be bigger in Christianity, like the Mother Teresa type, this extremism.
Mother Teresa is very, very, Jewish. If you read all sorts of stories and rabbinic literature of people who give away vast amounts of money to the poor, and we didn't develop monks. We might have. The Dead Sea Scrolls seem to have been a sect, seem to have been a celibate sect, and we have the Jewish Egyptian writer Philo in the late first century BCE, early first century CE, recording the existence of Jewish groups called the Therapeutae. There were male and female Therapeutae living separately, and they looked very, very like monks. They they're celibate. They give up everything. They go and live in the desert. They hold all their possessions in together. And the Dead Sea sect seems to be like this too. May or may not be the Essenes whom Josephus describes. So certainly in the first century CE, we have celibate Jewish groups who are living a very monastic looking life. And it's interesting that Christian monasticism starts in Egypt. And is there a link there back to Jewish traditions of a sort of celibate life before, which is possible? So we have had people who sacrifice their entire lives. Later on, possibly in reaction to Christianity, we don't do that anymore. We look at them going, well, we're not there. We don't do that. But we do have often extreme examples of giving to the poor, living for other people, and often thought of as a very good thing. We have lots of stories in the Holocaust of people who give up their lives so that other people can be saved. So I wouldn't say it's not a Jewish thing. To save others is always considered commendable in both religions. The whole monastic dedicating your life is more of a Christian thing, but in some ways, if you look at the modern Haredi world where men are expected to go off to yeshiva and only come back at the weekends to see their wives and families, it's a form of moderated monasticism. And that's sort of sometimes the only time that Haredi families who live under that sort of regime, they only see each other on Shabbat, not every Shabbat, and often for Chag, particularly in Hasidic circles, the Hasid will want to be with his Rebbe. Think of those huge annual pilgrimages to Uman before the Ukraine war, the Breslovers. No women went, or very, very few women went. It was a male thing. So all those families managed without the men for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So there's a sort of disguised monasticism, you could say, that lives on in the Haredi world in some ways. And there are definitely ascetic texts from the Middle Ages, about people, mystics rolling in snow and all the rest, and fasting every Monday and Thursday and barely eating and barely sleeping. And so we have a lot of the same impulses. They're just not part, you could say, of mainstream modern Orthodox culture so much. But there's similarities. There are some remarkable similarities, definitely. So there's some more chat come in. See Robert Alter for a critique of martyrdom in the Masada complex. Oh, entirely possible. Sounds interesting. Nazarite says the reading is still under requirement having sex with their wives too. Yes. Well, again, there's this huge tension, and a lot of people have written about this in the academic world, this sort of tension in Talmudic culture between the alapas, they're called, of the Torah and the wife, and how they can't be together. You can study Torah, but you have to be away from your wife. You can be with your wife, but you have to be away from Torah, and the tension that builds up between that. So Jeffrey Rubenstein has written on that sort of tension in Talmudic culture, and it's a tension that exists in the Haredi world as well. There are very, very rare examples of Haredi rabbis not getting married, or sometimes people on the margins, actually, like, the Sridi Esh never married, but they are rare because we have definitely centralized the value of marriage and procreation, even if the Haredi world in some places, not all, has done its best to make that not a relationship of emotional satisfaction so much as a means of procreating, but then keeping people very, very apart as well. So there are all sorts of modulations of the way you can do that. So that's why I call it sort of a modified monasticism in some parts of the Haredi world, where it's just the minimum. Okay, see your wife once a week, have kids, boom. But your life is spent at the yeshiva, your life is spent learning in the company of other men. And yeah, so it's a modified form. Why don't we do it outright? Because the Christians do it. So it's another way of differentiating ourselves between us and them. Yeah. Okay.
Did you say the Sridi Esh wasn't married?
Yes.
Not true. Read Mark Shapiro's biography.
I edited it.
He was married. It was unfortunate. And then
I edited that book. He was married, and then when his wife died, he was married for a little while, never got married again, didn't have any children. Yeah, very, very briefly. Yeah, but that was, I think, before the war. He never got married again, and it seems to have lasted a couple of years, and he got divorced. It's not at all clear what was going on there. Yeah, but it was maybe just he was pressured into. But it's interesting he never did get married again because that would have been the obvious way to do it. Yeah, yep, yes. First book I edited for the Lippmann Library, that was. Okay, so see you next week. And till then, have a good week. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.